From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. How do scientists evaluate the social implications that arise from their medical and biological inquiries? How should scientists and citizens collaborate in the creation of public policy? With particular regard to science and the unborn, those questions are central to the professional concerns of two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, Clifford Grobstein of the University of California and Malcolm Potts, president of Family Health International, a family planning research office. Clifford Grobstein has served as dean of the School of Medicine and vice chancellor for health sciences at the University of California at San Diego. He's currently chairman of the Advisory Committee on Ethics and Values in Science and Technology of the National Science Foundation. Malcolm Potts is the author of books and articles about reproductive medicine and international family planning research. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Medicine. Clifford Grobstein, let me be utterly naive. Is there any sort of consensus in the scientific community when scientists, specialists in biomedical issues talk about, when they attempt to define human life?
Well, I think it is appropriate to begin with it because we have a good deal of confusion about definitions. And I'm not sure that anyone at this point can say exactly what some of the words that are used in this discourse should mean. Mm-hmm. We rely on the kinds of meanings that have grown up over time. From a scientific point of view, of course, one tries very hard to use language that is unambiguous and precise and all of the rest.
Right.
And when one gets into an area of this kind, which already has its own vocabulary but not very precise, scientists sort of defensively try to be even more precise in what they're talking about. And it's true that I've recently begun thinking of the word individuality as being useful in this connection, and I've been trying to make it more precise in my own mind and hopefully then to others as well. Not that it's a new word, it's been used for a long time too. But in any event, when you talk about whether there, or you ask about whether there is a consensus on what it means to say that life begins at some point. I think scientifically there's a reasonable consensus on that if we use scientific vocabulary. Scientists, I think, universally would say that life doesn't begin on the Earth today. Mm-hmm. Some 100 or 150 years ago, that was an issue, and it was examined very carefully over a period maybe of a century. What begins is a new generation,
mm-hmm.
you see. And if one is thinking of a human life, as one says, when does an a human life, meaning a particular individual life, then yes, something begins at fertilization. At fertilization, what happens is that the combination of the genetic contributions from the two parents come together to make a brand new and usually different genotype or genome or hereditary constitution. And that's a very significant event. I mean, that is the beginning of genetic individuality in the language that I'm now using.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite significant. But it's also necessary, and I think there's a general consensus on that, in recognizing that genetic individuality is not equal to what we call a human being in the adult sense, that in common communication, that's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Genetic individuality is one attribute or aspect of this complex individuality that we're all concerned about.
Clifford Grobstein, Malcolm Potts, our topic is science and the unborn. Comment for me on some of the definitions being set forth about the value, the nature, the origins of human life, human identity, as these are coming from, what will we call them, various communities, legal, ethical, philosophical, moral, religious. How much do you sense the interplay between the scientific community, strictly speaking, and these other sorts of forces that that impinge upon the work that biomedical specialists engage in? Malcolm, can you comment on that for me?
It's interesting to look at this historically. Until the beginning of the 19th century, the few people that thought about this topic really belong to one word, world. If you read Aristotle, he is talking about the problems of development as much as embryology could be understood in his day. He's also talking about the human soul, and he uses the word soul in somewhat the same way as an embryologist might use the word inducer or an enzyme, something that makes the embryo grow and become more complicated, something which animates the body, the functions we now ascribe to the nervous system. And I suppose, you know, that theologians read Aristotle and natural scientists listened to theologians until about 150 years ago. And then the world seemed to break up into its various disciplines, and now we find that these people are often, or these different disciplines, no longer seem to communicate. And I think that's very, very sad. We want to go back, I think, to a world where we try to get harmony between these views, because mm-hmm. I think we've all got knowledge to share and to contribute to a complicated problem.
Mm-hmm.
The world really falls into two areas philosophically. Europe and most of the developed countries try to establish a consensus to say, well, there's a time in pregnancy when for certain indications it may be reasonable to do an abortion, and after a certain date, sometimes 12 weeks, perhaps we shouldn't do the operation at all, or perhaps it should be done for very, very special reasons like threat to the woman's life. The United States is different. The philosophy which the Supreme Court set up when it struck down state laws restricting abortion and created the present situation where abortion is a matter of a woman's choice, the philosophy the Supreme Court set up was to say that biologists, physicians, theologians are unable to decide when human life begins, that it's an affirmation of belief, what we actually conclude. And therefore, it's basically a religious decision in which the state has no part. And the Supreme Court said if these various disciplines cannot decide when life begins, then it's not the role of the judiciary to do this. So that you have a different philosophy, which is a more radical one, which may also be the reason that the temperature of the debate is very much hotter in the United States than it is in other countries. The same elements appear in other countries, but not the vitriol, not the difficulty of communicating between mm-hmm. different parties.
Mm-hmm. Clifford Grobstein, can you comment on that?
Well, I think that what Dr. Potts has said with respect to the status in the global scene is quite correct. I would point out that there's a globality, if you like, to this with respect to the scientific and medical activity. The first case, for example, I'm now referring to a particular example of the importance of defining the status of the unborn. The first case of in vitro fertilization, which also raises issues about the status of the unborn, occurred in England. But the fact is that it has, over the last 5 to 10 years, spread very rapidly in the world, mm-hmm. so that today probably a third of the countries in the world have reported some cases of in vitro fertilization. On the other hand, it doesn't occur everywhere. It particularly occurs in the developed areas. This is, if you like, a high-tech kind of development for the moment. And so its distribution is not uniform over the world.
So in a way, we in America enjoy a sort of luxury in the debate that we have, perspectives, angles, technological elements that, as you say, Dr. Potts has said, raises the temperature of the discussants.
That's correct, and therefore becomes a greater burden in public policy in those areas. Uh-huh. I think that in developing countries at the present time, if you mentioned in vitro fertilization and the fact that this has raised the problem of the status of the embryo prior to implantation, they would say, well, so what?
Uh-huh.
That's no problem for us. We're not going to worry about that particular one, and we don't need any policy because we're not at the moment particularly anxious to begin programs in vitro fertilization. Uh-huh. So on an international scale, although one could say that when you talk about defining the status of the very early stages of human development, that that's a universal human problem, mm-hmm. and undoubtedly down the road it is, as perceived at the present time, it's perceived very differently in mm-hmm. different parts of the world.
What is the level of scientific discourse? How would you characterize the kind of talk, formal and informal, that goes on among and between scientists, and how does that reach the public? Is the public well served in its perception of these very difficult issues? Malcolm Potts, you run Family Health International. Again, you see this not only in the United States but all over the world.
Probably biologists have not done a very good job in sharing their knowledge. I believe that most of the listeners to this program think these are complicated topics and they wish to have additional information. A small minority at both ends of the spectrum have very strong views and probably don't want to listen to any additional information. Mm-hmm. I was surprised when Professor Grobstein was saying the other day that a poll had shown that a significant number of Americans thought that the embryo had some sort of a brain when it was 1 week old. And I think we haven't shared with the public our insights, in particularly into the first 2 weeks of human development, the time that's been when the embryo has been manipulated in vitro fertilization. This seems to frighten people, like nuclear power frightens people. In fact, frogs fertilize their frog spawn in dirty streams all the time. There's nothing particularly remarkable about fertilizing an egg outside a living body. Now, there's anything particularly remarkable about the ability to transfer a free living egg from one individual to another. This has been done commercially in cattle for a very long time. I'm not saying there aren't important ethical decisions there, but we shouldn't be surprised or frightened by the technology, which is a relatively easy one to understand. When the egg is fertilized, it floats in a salty liquid, which is easy to make in a laboratory, for about 100 hours. Even when it begins to develop after that, it is primarily making placental afterbirth tissue. And the embryo doesn't begin really to appear in the human development, that the cells which are going to become you and I aren't really separated and don't have any definition until about 2 weeks after fertilization. In fact, some Catholic theologians have pointed out that if one believes in a human soul, then a human soul is indivisible. And it could not enter the embryo prior to the time when identical twins form. Now, a common misconception is identical twins form when the egg divides. They don't. Identical twins arise about 10 to 14 days after fertilization, when what embryologists call the primitive streak, the first axis within the embryo, appears. If two axes appear, there are two identical individuals. If they join together, there are Siamese twins.
Let me ask you to pause on a point that you've just raised here, Malcolm Potts. Your example of Catholic theology and questions about the soul, when it begins, that sort of thing. Do scientists talk about that sort of stuff? Do they are they interested in it in any sort of an institutional scientific sense? Clifford Grobstein?
Well, in my observations, I think the simplest answer would be no. Mm-hmm. That is
it's too risky? It's just not a part of what they're interested in? What?
It's not relevant. Having once laid down their directions or their hope for achievements, how they're going to go about things, it's long past time when there was any argument in the scientific community about which is the better way to go in terms of scientific objectives, the scientific method versus religious or other philosophy. Uh-huh. Scientists are not philosophers, not in what they do at the bench, not when they think how to solve their problems. They're following pretty well ingrained, and I don't mean not changed and modified, but they're pretty well ingrained habits of thought, and they exclude questions like that. I've certainly not heard any scientists, in considering a scientific issue, consider the possibility that a soul might be involved. Mm-hmm. That's not a scientific explanation.
So what we have, Clifford Grobstein, Malcolm Potts, what is the two sort of parallel kinds of discourse that may or may not complement one another? For example, the theological or the religious, and then the scientific. Is there a necessary tension between the two? Malcolm?
I don't think so. Again, I think it comes back to the way we use definitions. We don't ask astronomers to look at the constellations to see if they can see the pearly gates and tell us whether heaven exists or not. And I don't think we should ask biologists to look down a microscope, right, and to tell us whether the soul exists. So I think we come back to what are the biological facts, which are not in dispute, although perhaps not insufficiently shared. And how can we use words which will help us define the status of the developing embryo, the fertilized egg, etc. I think this is the important point. I think this is where Professor Grobstein has been, contributing a lot by putting ideas in order. Mm-hmm. I like the sort of the ladder of individuality that you've come up with, Clifford, because I think that's a quick summary that makes sense biologically, which we should share with other people, and which I think theologians and ethicists can mm-hmm. then can look at. I think that they're musings have to be congruent with biology. We can't have two worlds in conflict here.
Mm-hmm. Clifford Grobstein, let me ask you to elaborate on the subject of your lecture at the University in Chapel Hill, Science in the Unborn. Briefly elaborate for me the allusion that Malcolm Potts has just made here to this figure, this analogy of a ladder.
Well, as a matter of fact, I like that term. I don't know that I used it myself, but I think it's a welcome way to look at it. It is a ladder in the sense that it suggests that there is sequence as one analogous to moving upward on a ladder, that there is a sequence in development that moves upward. It moves upward in terms of complexity. It moves upward from the initial state of relative simplicity, relative degree of understanding, to this really massively complex thing. We don't think of an infant as being massively complex, but from a biological point of view, it is. And to jump from the egg to the infant and pay no attention to the rungs of the ladder that mm-hmm. Are climbed in order to get there, I think, is a distortion of the process and represents a failure to understand what science has painfully put together about that process. Mm-hmm. Doesn't understand it entirely by any means, but understands it much better than to assume that you snap your finger or you push a button, you turn on an electric light. Those are very poor analogies for what happens between an egg and an infant.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what, very gropingly, one is trying to say when one talks about these successive steps in the acquirement of individuality and likened to a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about science and the unborn. The Soundings panelists are Clifford Grobstein of the University of California at San Diego and Malcolm Potts, president of Family Health International, a family planning research office. Clifford Grobstein has served as dean of the School of Medicine and vice chancellor of health sciences at the University of California at San Diego. He's currently chairman of the Advisory Committee on Ethics and Values in Science and Technology of the National Science Foundation. Malcolm Potts has written books and articles about reproductive medicine and international family planning research. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Medicine.
Clifford Grobstein, Malcolm Potts, our topic is science and the unborn. Let me take you just a little bit afield. Both of you are scientists. Comment for me on, characterize for me the nature of the political debate, the cultural debate that surrounds these very difficult issues. Malcolm Potts?
Perhaps I could illustrate this. A few years ago, President Reagan said words to the effect that biologists don't seem to be able to tell us when life begins, therefore shouldn't we be cautious?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this expresses the opinions of many people in America. They're worried about the topic. They think our technology's running wild. And to answer President Reagan's question, one really has to get a little bit into semantics and go back to, what question you're asking when you say, when does life begin? A mushroom and a cockroach and a ballerina are all living things. We have to be more careful than talking about life. And if we talk about individuality, then we get back to the continuum. And the consensus, which I think goes along most biologists, that while one is awed by the early embryo and its potential, one doesn't treat it in the same way as you would do a newborn infant. And as a person who works in family planning, I'm not going to lie awake at night worrying about the fact that an intrauterine device or even an oral contraceptive may sometimes be responsible for the death of a fertilized egg. And I don't think, because I don't worry about that I'm any more likely to commit infanticide than anyone that's listening to this broadcast. I find it offensive when people make that jump. But I also realize that I've got an obligation to explain at greater length why I think those two things are different. They seem to me very different, but there's no Rubicon in between them. I wish there was, but there is no moment when you can say, this is something as trivial as a nail paring, and after this point, this is has the status of a newborn child. Mm-hmm. You have to make some decisions to divide up a continuous biological process. And this is not a unique problem. We have to do this in life after birth. We have to do it in life before birth.
Clifford Grobstein?
Well, you asked us really two questions. First, you asked us to make some kind of statement about how scientists as a community feel about something, and you asked us particularly how do they feel about abortion. Number one, I'd have to say, there isn't any way that I know to characterize what the scientific community believes, because it's extremely heterogeneous, just as all other communities are.
It's not monolithic.
It's not by any means monolithic.
All right.
Now, if it comes to the characteristics of their scientific activity, then you'll find there's a good deal of consensus. If there's concern, if the question is how do they feel about public support of science, namely their own activities, I think you'll find a good deal of consensus. They want as much public support as they can get.
Sure.
But when you ask about a matter like what do they think about the controversy about the status of the unborn, I think you'll find that they vary pretty much the way the general community does if they're taking everything into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, therefore, I have to speak only for the particular segment that I can feel sure about, namely myself and people who think like me. And I would say that with respect to the present controversy over abortion, which is intense, and which I believe now has to be seen as a particular instance of the broader issue of the status of the unborn, the matter has settled into what I can only liken to the kind of trench warfare that occurred in the First World War that led to the Maginot mentality of the preparation for the Second World War, namely that sooner or later there'd be a stalemate and you'd have to work over micro distances instead of mega large distances. And it seems to me that the opponents in the abortion controversy have settled down to that kind of steady trench warfare, which is terribly wearing not only on the participants but everybody in the community, and which has tended to polarize many other things.
Mm-hmm.
A most unfortunate situation. Now, I am not an advocate of warfare, but if we're at war, activity, movement is preferable to settling into such fixed positions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need that at the present time. And I'm hopeful that since there are new sort of arenas now in which this has to be discussed anyway, the status of the embryo, that that may flexibilize the situation. Mm-hmm. And get us off into mm-hmm. a newer perspective.
Clifford Grobstein, Malcolm Potts, let's conclude our conversation. Our topic is science and the unborn. A few minutes ago, Professor Grobstein used the figure of trench warfare. Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? How do you look down the road here, and what do you see regarding the debate over science and the unborn? Professor Grobstein?
Well, I certainly anticipate that the stalemate that has existed for the last 5 years, I think earlier we made some reference to the fact that although there's a good deal being said and a good deal of effort being expended, that very little new has come out mm-hmm. in the debate of, say, the last 5 years. It's mostly a matter of position-seeking, advantage-seeking, mm-hmm. and so on, between combatants who are looking for some advantage mm-hmm. in the conflict.
But just parenthetically, I heard you say in one discussion that the scientific knowledge has flourished within the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, but this is the scientific knowledge which is relevant, but not doesn't directly bear and certainly hasn't been accumulating because of the conflict in an effort to deal with it.
I see.
But that, I think, is part of what I personally feel optimistic about. I think that the changing science and the changing technology are altering the base, even though the directly involved combatants don't mm-hmm. see it. So that the ground is shifting under their feet. And I think that the orientation and perspective will be changed, and it will necessarily redefine the rules in ways that will not involve such rigid conflict. Now, in that sense, I'm optimistic. And we've seen that happen in other controversies that get locked this way.
In bioethics,
uh-huh. Where the combatants are really not paying attention to the general scene anymore. They're so totally devoted to the particular conflict they're mm-hmm. in. And that is unfortunate in one way, but in terms of a long-range perspective, at the moment, I think we can be optimistic that things are likely to be unlocked by what is going on in the background of the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Malcolm Potts?
I think it will go that way, although there'll be a lot of pain and suffering on the way. Daniel Callahan, who is a Catholic lay ethicist, has said that many people say that God says you shouldn't take innocent life, but we omit to recognize the fact that human beings have to define innocent life. And there's nothing for those people who are religious, there's nothing in scripture that tells us what to do. It's a human definition. And therefore, it seems to me the battle over abortion is somewhat like the 16th century battles over religion, when it's obviously very important, if you believe in an afterlife, to make it as likely as possible that somebody's soul can enjoy such an afterlife. And that was the basis of a 100 years war that destroyed Europe. And eventually people with different opinions realized that tolerance was not only a necessity, but that it was perhaps one of the highest social virtues that exists. And particularly in America, which is a country born on tolerance, then my own thinking goes back to the Supreme Court ruling, which doesn't say abortion is right or wrong. It says we have to distinguish between those affirmations of faith that people make in interpreting human development, which differ between different groups, different sects, if you like, the pro-choice and the right to lifers and other people. And we have to accommodate those differences, just as society accommodates, I believe with pride, different religious traditions within society. And I believe it should be no more surprising to have an abortion clinic in a city where many citizens are deeply opposed and disturbed by abortion than it is to have a mosque and a synagogue and a Catholic and a Protestant church all on the same street, which is a possibility. They all say profoundly different things about the spiritual interpretation of the physical world in which we live, and yet we accommodate those differences. Mm-hmm. We haven't yet learnt to accommodate different interpretations in relation to life before birth in the way that we have life after death. But in the end, I'm sure we will get there. I hope we will do it without too much distraction. I hope we will do it with respect for various groups and love between them and not hostility.
Clifford Grobstein.
I will limit myself to joining in the sentiments just expressed by Dr. Potts. I'm sure that's what we hope for. I'm sure that most people listening would hope for that. I agree that we're likely to see still some stormy days, but hopefully we're seeing the sun rising somewhere in the future.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about science and the unborn. The Soundings panelists were Clifford Grobstein of the University of California and Malcolm Potts, president of Family Health International. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Science and the Unborn, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The views expressed in the foregoing discussion were personal, not institutional. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about women, philosophy, and public policy. The Soundings panelists will be Kate Young of the Institute of Development Studies at the University of Sussex, and Sarah Ruddock of the New School for Social Research. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for a conversation about science and the unborn. The Soundings panelists will be Clifford Grobstein of the University of California and Malcolm Potts, president of Family Health International. How do scientists evaluate the social implications arising from their medical and biological inquiries? With respect to science and the unborn, how should scientists and citizens collaborate in the creation of public policy? Science and the Unborn, Some Answers and Insights, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.